Hello, today is May the 14th of 2026. My name is Kayla Verhoeven, and we're going to go ahead and start off with part one of the pantograph. History lives at Ewing Manor, decade of restoration done, Reddy's Mansion for Centennial by Caitlin Klepek, 28 minutes ago. The Ewing Cultural Center, set on Bloomington Sunset Hill, features historic Ewing Manor, the theater, and Ewing and the Genevieve Green Gardens, all surrounded by 6.5 acres of wooded landscape. Local history. Bloomington. Ewing Manor has completed its more than decade-long restoration effort as the historic home approaches its centennial in 2028. Tony Tucker, director of the Ewing Cultural Center and associate director of the University Advancement at Illinois State University, took on the massive project back in 2014. It was a lot of going through old pictures, old drawings, and stuff to figure out. What did this originally look like? Tucker said. The Channel Norman-style manor was completed in 1929 and was the home of Davis and Hazel Buck Ewing. Davis Ewing was active in the local community and owned a concrete company that played a major role in paving Bloomington's original streets and sidewalks, some of which still exist today. Hazel Buck Ewing was a women's rights activist who supported several social causes, and she established the School of Nationus and Principia College and helped found the School of Nursing at Illinois Wesleyan, among other endeavors. Preserving history. Tucker and her team took on a 25-year plan to finish up restorations at the mansion in a historically accurate way, with the goal of preserving its originality. With the help of her crew, Tucker has now finished the plan in conjunction with her anticipated retirement in June, years before the project was expected to be completed. The Ewing Cultural Center worked with several local contractors to finish the restoration. Preservation and restoration is one of the most important things that the public as a whole needs to understand, said Derek Baum, contractor at Autobaum, because this is connections that we have back to times, places, and people that we knew nothing about. To build this house how it is now, it would be impossible. Keel Vandegraft, owner of R.W. Vandegraft Painting and Decorating, agreed, adding, "It's like reading a history book. There's a reason we teach history. Glass, stone, and more." In 2013, a Chicago-based architectural firm conducted a comprehensive study of the manor's exterior and identified the stained glass windows as doors and as a priority for restoration, Tucker said. Jacksonville Stained Glass reinstalled the final windows April the 20th, bringing the multi-year project to a close. Now, the 98-year-old stained glass windows are fully operational and prepared to serve the manor for decades to come. The glasswork was done alongside other major interior and exterior projects, including restoration of the manor's slate roof and patio, exterior stonework, repointing, and sealing its cypress wood. Inside, the plaster walls were repaired, original furniture and clothing was brought back into the home, and Hazel Buck Ewing's player piano was restored with the ability to play its original roles. Contractors and project leaders alike agreed the restoration process took a lot of trial and error as they met challenges in maintaining a building of this age and significance. All 104 exterior windows and doors had to be redone. Much of the stonework required a full repair. Baum said the mortar was completely in need of being replaced. Tucker added, "You would touch it and it was like sand." For preservation of the building and garden walls, crews worked to re-tuck point the entire building, a process by which stone masons cut out old, deteriorated mortar and replace it with new, color-matched mortar. Baum said the process took about 3.5 months between site surveys and mortar and stone testing to make sure the new mortar would be softer than the material it surrounds to accommodate the stone's expansion with temperature changes. Maintaining the manor's majesty. Our process is restoration, not replacement, Tucker said. Baum said maintenance is key. It's just an exponential sort of thing, where if you maintain it and maintain it, you're good. But as soon as the building gets to a certain age and a certain state of deterioration, the cost just dramatically increases every year, he said. The slate roof, which contains 15 tons or 12,000 feet of the rock, was restored using real slate, then replacing it with vinyl, Tucker said, adding that she insisted it was the best way to return the roof to its former glory. Vandercroft said much of his work focused on keeping the manor in its original state, focused on figuring out the plaster walls and color matching. The walls here are completely different, he said, noting the exterior walls have clay blocking and a scratch coat plaster. Some of these walls are probably pushing 2 foot thick, and the ceiling in here is all poured concrete, Vandergraaf said. There's so many different types of substances in here that you almost have to dissect it piece by piece to figure out what the original order was of all of it. Tucker said the cultural center is fortunate to have the original documents and blueprints for the building, giving them somewhat of a guide. She expanded on that guide by creating lists of each paint color, including mixes and colorants for future use. Tucker said she also created a maintenance schedule for the building, noting each project's completion date and when to review the work in the future. Brock Spencer of J. Spencer Construction, LLC, served as a general contractor and contributed carpentry work to the overall restoration. His crew repaired woodwork in the theater at Ewing, home to the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, following water damage, and also helped Vandergraaf with plaster repairs. Vandergraaf called it a team effort, and Tucker added, "Everyone works together. It's not piece by piece." Spencer said the most interesting part of the restoration process was the removal of a beehive on the second floor that required contractors to remove fascia and soffit. A bee expert came in to remove the bees. Spencer said he appreciates seeing the building and grounds open to the public once again, noting how important it is to really take care of it and cherish it. "There's such a rich history in this home," Tucker said, "and I know we talk about the restoration and the preservation of it, but it's the people that lived here." Quoting a letter written by Davis Ewing to his son, Tucker said, "I hope someone will appreciate the authenticity of Sunset Hill. It was beautifully built." With tears in her eyes, she added, "We are appreciative." In other news, Lincoln College has a sale ahead. Zoning vote expected to aid redevelopment, by Drew Zimmerman 28 minutes ago. A statue of Abraham Lincoln reading a book stands at the entrance of the Lincoln College in March of 2022. Logan County, Lincoln. Zoning changes at the Lincoln College campus aiming to facilitate new residential and commercial development opportunities will be up for City Council consideration next week. During a non-voting session on Tuesday, the Lincoln City Council heard from Chase Houston, who is planning to purchase the Lincoln College property. Although he lives in Washington, Houston has invested in real estate within the city for the last 10 years, including roughly 100 rental properties and 240 storage units. Houston said his vision is to transform the campus into a mixed-use community with roughly 200 apartments, small businesses, and community spaces, all while preserving the legacy of the 160-year-old campus, which closed its doors in 2022 because of declining enrollment. The developer said he receives calls on a weekly basis from individuals interested in moving to Lincoln, but there are no housing options available, and it would be too cost prohibitive to start building new houses. "I think the big question at the crux of all this is, if we do nothing, what will happen versus if we do something with the position of taking care of the facility and taking care of the community. What's possible, and it could really be anything," Houston said. The plan would be to convert the existing dormitories into 1- and 2-bedroom apartments. The remaining buildings on campus would be utilized as lease space for specific business uses. Wes Woodhall, building and safety official for Lincoln, said the college has many quality parties who have expressed interest in some of the property, but not the entire site. If the deal goes through, Houston said he has had conversations with those same parties about accommodating their needs. Although the initial goal was around 200 units, Woodhall also said that the number may have decreased because of the need for 2 to 3 bedroom apartments. But in order for Houston to develop the market these properties, if he is to purchase agreement would go through, the city of Lincoln must rezone the campus. The property is currently zoned as R2, which limits the number of eligible developments. According to city code, the only permitted uses of R2 zoning is bed and breakfast establishments, 1 to 2 family dwellings, and community integrated living arrangements. But if the property was zoned as C2, the site could accommodate any projects that are eligible within residential or commercial districts. The Lincoln Planning Commission met last week and recommended the proposed rezoning. Vic Marketek, who serves on the Lincoln Planning Commission, said during the public comment period of Tuesday's meeting that this is one of the biggest opportunities to come to Lincoln in a long time, and it gives the city the opportunity to put a large parcel back on the tax rolls. Alderman Kevin Bateman said one of the primary concerns he has heard from the constituents is either the apartments would become government-subsidized housing if tenants couldn't be found. Houston said the project will never rely on government subsidies. He added that the sale of the property may happen in the event the apartments can't be filled or businesses can't be lined up, but only as a last resort. Patrick Doolin, a Lincoln College trustee who also serves on the private Lincoln College Legacy Foundation, said the decision was made to close the college before it became insolvent. This was to make sure students were taken care of, faculty and staff were able to receive severance pay, and the board would have some say over the institution's assets. Although money has been budgeted over the last 4 years to maintain the campus and its buildings, the board will be unable to maintain its upkeep procedures throughout the calendar year. It's down to the bare bones that we can do now, Doolin said. In fact, we're paying security to be on site certain days of the week to monitor things and catch things which are very expensive. Before Houston came forward, Doolin said preliminary paperwork was completed to take the Lincoln College property to auction. With an auction, we have no control over who buys it, where they're from, what they're going to do with it, how they're going to maintain it, or how they're going to treat it, or whether they care about the historical value of it or not, Doolin said. Thankfully, Mr. Houston stepped up, and we got an agreement in place before that deadline was triggered. However, if the deal with Houston does not go through, Doolin said the auction process would resume. Before the city council votes on the rezoning ordinance, staff will add a right of first refusal, which gives the city the priority option to buy the property before the owner sells it to a third party. A condition of sale stipulating that the rezoning would only occur at the time of the purchase would also be added. The ordinance will be included as an action item on Monday's City Council meeting, which will be set at 6 p.m. in the Council Chambers of Lincoln City Hall at 700 Broadway Street. Moving on now to other health news, the hantavirus anxiety hits after COVID. Cruise ship outbreak similar to the pandemic start, by Alyssa Goldberg, USA Today, 28 minutes ago. Public health. A hantavirus outbreak aboard a cruise ship last week, which led to several passenger deaths, stirred up anxiety and feelings of unease for many people who are still grappling with the long-lasting impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. On Sunday, an American passenger tested positive for the Andy strain, which is only the hantavirus known to spread between humans. While the World Health Organization maintains that public health risk from the virus remains low, the outbreak's origins feel eerily similar to the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, when a coronavirus outbreak on the Diamond Princess cruise ship in February of 2020 infected over 600 of the 3,700 passengers and crew, 17% of the people. The effects of COVID, emotionally and physically, still weigh on the American healthcare infrastructure and workforce. Long COVID, which can affect multiple body systems and is significantly disrupts daily life, affects 5% to 7% of U.S. adults, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the Department of Health and Human Services. Roughly 1 million people are out of the workforce at any given time because of long COVID, according to the NIH. Experts say news of the recent hantavirus outbreak can be quote-unquote especially alarming, following the collective trauma experienced during the COVID-19 pandemic. The evolving prolonged impact of news surrounding illness, loss, and loneliness, as well as lingering questions of it, when and how we would survive it, took an enormous toll on our lives and psyches, said Dr. Vanessa Kennedy, clinical therapist and director of psychology at Driftwood Recovery. We may be experiencing the resurfacing of familiar anxieties, fear, and confusion as news unfolds. People have turned to TikTok to express these fears. Trying to work like normal while also having raging anxiety about the hantivirus, one user said in a video with over 500,000 views. I have really bad health OCD and anxiety, another content creator shared. When I tell you I do not play, like I heard about bird flu and I haven't eaten a runny egg in like 2 years. She added that misinformation around the hantivirus has made it more difficult to navigate this anxiety. But health experts say we are not in the same situation we were in 6 years ago. While this outbreak is a serious incident, according to Dr. Maria Van Kerkhove, director of the WHO's Department of Epidemic and Pandemic Management, this is not the start of a pandemic. At this point, Americans should beware of hantavirus, but not too alarmed, said Dr. Nikhil Bahani, an infectious disease expert. Hantiviruses do not spread as easily as other respiratory illnesses, like influenza or COVID, he said. Close, prolonged contact is needed for hantiviruses to spread between individuals. Flight, fight, or freeze is an automatic response to threatening events or stressors in which adrenaline and cortisol levels rise in the body to prepare for survival. As traumatic events become chronic, prolonged, or complex, as in the case of the evolving effects of COVID-19 over several years, our trauma responses can become overactive, depleting our energy, taxing our bodies and minds, and causing irritability, emotional volatility, or numbness, Kerkhove explained. This leaves people more vulnerable to symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, aka PTSD. Those who experienced the death of loved ones to COVID were personally ill or suffered emotional distress from prolonged isolation may have even more severe trauma responses, Kerkhove said. Stephanie Starkus, a psychotherapist specializing in attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and anxiety, says emotional desensitization can happen after prolonged exposure to stressors. Many people are still carrying unresolved trauma and anxiety from COVID, while also navigating the political conflict, the war, financial strains, climate anxiety, and a constant stream of distressing news, she said. At a certain point, the mind may create emotional distance as a form of self-preservation. This can result in quote-unquote emotional numbing. On TikTok, some people have joked that they're going to participate in TikTok trends, this lockdown chasing the clout and success that many influencers found during COVID. Some people are even betting on the next pandemic via Poly Market. However, Sarkis said some people use dark humor to cope with tragedy or fears surrounding a health crisis, while still exhibiting emotional intelligence or empathy in their interpersonal relationships or other parts of their lives. But the more people emotionally distance themselves, Sarkis said, the more desensitized they become to human pain. So how can people stay informed without engaging in constant doom scrolling, spiraling into anxiety, or taking dark humor too far? Kirkov said it can be healthy to limit yourself to checking news updates only once or twice per day. Seeking out trusted news sources and relying on public health officials rather than unverified social media posts or conspiracy theorists can curb unnecessary anxieties that can arise from misinformation or fear-mongering. In other state and federal news, SNAP cuts the wrist to grocers. With the loss of federal food aid, stores face debt and closure. By Jenna Swikert, Capital News, Illinois, 56 minutes ago. Craig Nora Burns, a fourth-generation Illinois grocer, poses in one of the four independent groceries he owns in southern Illinois. Noren Burns testified before a House committee about the potential impacts SNAP cuts will have on independent grocers. Illinois. As households across Illinois brace to lose their federal food assistance this month, grocery stores, especially independent grocers across the state, are preparing for the devastating effects of decreased spending. For some independent grocers, whose profits margins average 2%, a decrease in consumer spending associated with cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program could lead to store closures. Changes to SNAP from the quote-unquote One Big Beautiful Bill Act, also known as H.R. 1, mean that thousands of Illinois households will lose access to their SNAP benefits in May if they did not fulfill new work requirements or submit for an exemption. Grocery stores operate on some of the slimmest profit margins of any business because, combined with the high operating costs, they sell almost exclusively low-priced items, and so must sell a lot of product to make up for small sales, said Craig Norenburns, a fourth-generation Illinois grocer. We're in what we call the penny business, meaning that like we count and survive on the penny, Noren Burns said. And because grocers deal with many perishable items, it is very easy to lose that profit, he added. Noren Burns is a member of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, which represents independent and corporate grocers of all sizes. Retailers have the narrowest profit margin of all business sectors, IRMA President Rob Carr said. Within that, grocers have the narrowest profit margins, averaging between 1 and 2%. Tariffs, fuel prices have had a major impact on the retailers who deal in transporting, packing, and importing a lot of products, Carr said. In stiff competition to that, and SNAP cuts, will put grocers at real risk for closures. When communities lose independent grocers, it impacts their ability to access food, especially products like fresh produce. It might actually have the inverse effect of driving more people into supplemental programs like SNAP, Carr said. Family business. Noren Burns has been working in his family's business for 15 years and now owns four independent grocers in southern Illinois, including the space his great-grandfather originally opened as a butcher shop in the 1930s. His grandfather, Tom, worked in and eventually bought a grocery store in Mascata and, along with his wife Betty Ann, expanded the operation throughout southern Illinois. The pair passed the business to their three sons, TJ, Don, and John. Craig's father, TJ, later bought two independent Grocers Alliance stores, Red Bud in 1995 and Millstat in 2005. The Independent Grocers Alliance is a nationwide coalition of independent grocers that provides brand support to compete against chain stores while allowing those businesses to remain independent. Noren Burns saved the original Tom Supermarket from a bankruptcy sale in 2022, adding the store to the two his father had bought. He renamed it Betty Ann Market after his grandmother, and it remains the only independent grocery store in Mascataw. Then, just before Thanksgiving in 2025, Noren Burns purchased a fourth independent grocery in Highland using the Advantage Illinois program. Advantage Illinois is a state program that uses federal financing to help small businesses obtain loans by sharing the lending risk. The interest rate from Illinois Advantage might be, let's say, 2%, so a pretty low interest rate, which is great. But now the bank's interest rate at the time was like 6 or 7%, Norm Burns said. What they do is they take a blend of those two, and we ultimately end up paying 4 or 4.5%. In 2023, the state established the Illinois Grocery Initiative, aiming to address food insecurity, in part by offering grants to establish grocery stores in food deserts. Access to groceries, particularly fresh and healthy food, is indirectly correlated to community health. Norm Burns said the state had done a quote-unquote pretty good job of making loans and grants like those available, but they don't cover everything. Grocery stores are expensive to run, especially with these rising energy costs. It costs more to get the food to our door, and it costs more to get the food on the shelf, Norm Burns said. It's very seldom in our business that we see, like, oh, hey, that fee now has been reduced, or that cost of this has gone down. It's not that. It's just not the reality that we're living in right now. The Governor J.B. Pritzker administration has put effort into using discretionary money to provide relief for grocers and pharmacies, Carr said. But there's only so much that the state can do, and what would provide real relief is if the federal government revisited their changes to SNAP, he said. SNAP cuts effects. In a worst-case scenario, owners may just have enough money to pay the bills, Norm Burns said. It's math, right? It's not rocket science here. Many independent grocery stores struggle to make substantial profits with high overhead costs and inconsistent consumer habits. And when consumer spending power is limited, like when they lose SNAP benefits, local businesses feel the effects of their limited spending. During the federal shutdown last fall, when some SNAP recipients didn't receive their November benefits, Norm Burns said he knew some business owners who saw the effects of that. They did what they had to do to get by, Norm Burns said. I think there's a lot of people that are struggling with credit card debt, you know? It's like, hey, we can't wait. What else do we do? Norm Burns and Carr said it's important to hold those programs accountable and minimize the fraud and overspending, but it's gone too far. Carr said that we are going to end up losing the recipients who we are serving. If the worst happens, bankruptcy, store closure, and communities can lose a vital piece of their economies. We've seen this happen in quite a few towns where the community loses the grocery store. But it has this trickle-down effect. The grocery store seems to be part of the heartbeat of the community, Norm Burns said. If you've got a really strong grocery store, you've got a really strong school district, other things are going to follow suit. But without those two things, it's really hard for communities to thrive. The communities that Norm Burns operates grocery stores in are not ones where the majority of residents are SNAP recipients. But he also works as a consultant with other business owners, including ones that looking to open grocery stores in Venice, an impoverished community in Madison County, where most of its residents receive SNAP benefits. The reality is, everybody's got to eat, Norm Burns said. What happens when there's a hunger crisis? It leads to crime. It leads to kids not being able to perform in school because they don't have food at home. On April the 29th, the House committee held a hearing on three bills lawmakers introduced to address the needs of losing these SNAP benefits. Committee members heard testimony from advocates, including Norm Burns, on behalf of the Realtors Association. While the House versions of all missed community committee deadlines, the Senate versions of the bill are still alive in the appropriations committees. Nolan Downey, senior director of the policy of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, said in his testimony that for every meal that food banks and food pantries provide to those in need, SNAP provides nine, and pantries cannot keep up with the kind of need associated with losing all these SNAP benefits. At the end of the day, people have got to come together. We've got to find some middle ground that makes sense, Norm Burns said. But the answer can't just be, well, let's just do more tax, right? There's got to be some new vision cast, whether that's from the current Pritzker administration or new administration. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundations. Thank you for joining me today, friends. This was part one of the Pantograph, and I hope you have a great day.